Stood in front of an unfamiliar piece of art and suddenly found yourself struck by a realization about the nature of the world? Or maybe you had a solution to a problem just pop into your head as if by magic. What happens when we stop using words and let materiality and abstraction do the talking? But wait, what am I saying? This is a podcast. Thank you for letting your mind wander over here to Digesting Food Studies, the series that speculates on that most deliciously expanding field of learning and knowing and doing that we call food studies. I'm your docent, David Santo. This episode is about how interpretation and material practice can construct alternative ways of making meaning in classrooms, gardens, factories, and kitchens. On today's show, we're talking about the reflexive and representational outcomes of food-related art, both its processes and its objects. Even though words and numbers are great ways of representing ideas and arguments, so are sculptures and paintings and dances and songs. Hearing, tasting, and feeling things rather than always visually reading them can help us understand food systems and food cultures in new ways, as well as the other systems in which we're embedded. Curious? Listen on. The article in focus comes from Volume 12, Issue 1 of Canadian Food Studies, published in May 2025. We open things up with Alexia Moyer's Amuse-Bouche segment, in which she and I revisit the world of tableware, utensils specifically, but this time from the perspective of personality and gender. And though we take the matter seriously, spoiler alert, there is a dad joke involved. Then, during my author talk with Susan Goldberg, we slip back in time a bit to the isolation of COVID and to the domestic labor and complex emotions that came about during that time. Though not a food scholar herself, Susan's art piece in the journal Milk and Bread reveals a great deal about food systems and what's important in our lives. Finally, in the aftertaste, recent master's graduate Kaylee Workington draws on her own thesis about the material legacies of wildfires to reflect and comment on Susan's art, and where material practice more generally can lead us. So Alexia, our amuse-bouche this week is kind of a special one because the author that I'll be talking to later on, Susan Goldberg, is actually not providing us with an example of food research, although maybe it is research, but it's an art piece. It's a collage. It's a couple of photos. It's a poem. It's a reflection, and it's also a projection, perhaps, from the past to the future through the present, and also thinking about the impacts of the COVID pandemic, which many of us have almost forgotten. But it's sort of thinking about the impacts of that time, not just on the author herself, but on all the people who are doing domestic labor in that period. And it's a very tender piece, don't you find?
It is. And it's very centered on everyday life and looking at it at a very close range.
Yeah.
So for that reason, we're headed back to cutlery.
Good.
That we looked at in episode one, but with less of an emphasis on its practical uses, but we're going to look at it in terms of gender.
Okay. So gendered cutlery.
Yes. So I'd like to indulge in a quick quiz.
Sure.
I'll name the implement and you name the gender.
Okay.
That comes to mind.
Yep.
So a knife.
A knife to me is very cis male, hetero.
Fork.
A fork to me is quite non-binary.
And spoon.
Spoon, I would say, is female, but maybe also trans. I think of spoons as very between spaces, covering many spaces, actually.
Margaret Visser sets up one particular model, and she cites Freud for this.
Oh, good. Always a useful reference point.
Exactly. So her analysis of knife, fork, and spoon is in which he assigns the spoon the female role, as they are curvy and womb-like.
Thank you, Sigmund.
Knives are phallic and masculine.
Of course, and sharp.
And forks are, and this is a surprise to me as well, forks are the male child of the knife and the spoon. And Visser adds to her summary, like Oedipus, forks are resentful of the knife and jealous of the spoon. I always thought of forks as girls, partly because I think I've been translating from the French, where it's preceded by a feminine article.
Oh, yeah.
La fourchette, une fourchette.
And the fourchette, even the E-T-T-E, gives it a kind of gamine quality.
Exactly, exactly. And I'm with you on the spoon. I never really thought of it as strictly feminine. And also, Visser writes, think of it as a bowl with a handle, which is something else that I've never really thought about. But it is exactly that. And yeah. The earliest spoon is two cupped hands.
Mm-hmm. Certainly a spoon is very nurturing. A spoon is a very useful implement for feeding a kid, mm-hmm. which has historically been quite a female gendered domestic practice. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, because they come in so many different dimensions and depths and purposes and materials that to me, that's why I said trans, they sort of cross gender for me.
They do. They come in all kinds of sizes, all kinds of uses. Some of them can stand up on their own because mm-hmm. they're flat mm-hmm. on the bottom, which I think is a great invention.
Then in a ladle is very big and deep and handled, and it's a serving implement, but it's not so much an eating implement, but it's kind of a spoon. But then what about the grapefruit spoon? A painful spoon, not nurturing at all. Well, maybe if you serve yourself, but it's not something I'd want to serve a kid with.
Yes, but it's a two-in-one, which is great because normally you would need both knife and spoon in a grapefruit. And this way, it's streamlining.
It's practical for camping.
Exactly. So Keogh McClear takes up this idea of anthropomorphizing cutlery and with it gendering to a certain extent of table utensils. And she wrote a children's book called Spork. And it's illustrated by Isabelle Arsenault. And the story begins, Spork was neither spoon nor fork, but a bit of both.
Ooh.
Now, Spork never seems to be taken out of the cutlery drawer, never gets a seat at the table or a warm, sudsy bath afterward, until one day a messy thing who has no knowledge of cutlery conventions comes along and, being a baby, has specific food delivery needs that only a spork can provide. And that is how Spork gets to participate in the rituals of dinner. So while we are rummaging around in our cutlery drawers, as Goldberg asks us to do, let us spare a moment for the grapefruit spoon, of course, the escargot fork, the jelly server, which, as I have since learned, is a spoon-shaped utensil with an edge along the one side.
Oh, yeah.
And it's used to slice and serve molded jellies like tomato aspic, which I know is on your menu for the week.
Always.
So they may very well like to fulfill their destinies, but they might like to make new ones. So for all we know, the escargot fork may harbor ambitions to become a fava bean fork. Now, let us remember also that knives and forks and spoons are not immutable. Their status, the ways in which they have been categorized, are ever evolving. So forks have gone from an object of ridicule to a tableware stalwart. They have also changed shape from one tine to two to three to four to five, back down to four tines.
I remember finding some old five-tined forks in my grandparents' cutlery drawers and thinking that they were sort of mutant forks. They were so tineful.
You should keep it. I think it'll have value.
No doubt.
In 1605, Thomas Artus satirized King Henri III of France and his companions for their fork-wielding behavior, writing, "They would rather touch their mouths with their little forked instruments than with their fingers," which to him felt very strange and alien.
Yeah.
And as we've discussed, spoons, they come in a range of sizes, and knives have lost much of their food work over the centuries, as we discussed in episode one. Now, Keogh's story is, as she writes, a multi-cutlery tale, and she seeks to acknowledge the liminal spaces occupied by hybrid identities, or what poet Fred Waugh calls that hazy margin of possibility, and what Keogh has called that spork space between languages, cultures, and countries. Now, a promotional song for the book perhaps says it best. There used to be lines that could never be crossed. The forks had their places. The spoons had their slots. But the tines, they are a changing.
Oh, groan and wonderful. The dead jokester in me is rolling on the floor laughing. The other part of me is rolling on the floor cringing. But I thank you for that lovely bit of song work.
Oh, well, I thank Q and McClear for that.
Well, we'll thank everyone involved. We'll thank the spork, too,
yes,
to begin with, for giving us the inspiration. Can't wait to dive into more. Thank you.
Susan Goldberg is a psychotherapist and artist who lives in Thunder Bay, Ontario. A longtime professional writer and a remarkable poet about food and many other things, Susan has become somewhat of an expert on those little plastic tags that we use to close up bags of milk and sleeves of bread. Well, Susan, thank you so much for joining us here on Digesting Food Studies. We're literally digesting some food today. Well, not literally, but figuratively. As we talk about your wonderful, beautiful combined art piece, both poetry and visuals, called Milk and Bread in a recent issue of the journal. Thank you. It's just, the piece is fabulous. So I'm just so excited to be talking to you.
Thank you.
Could you tell us sort of how this came apart? You describe it in the artist statement in the piece, but what was it that brought you towards the use of bread and milk tags to make art?
It started because I would, you know, be just in my kitchen and I would open the cutlery drawer or look on the windowsill and I'd have these, I actually have one like on my desk right now, but the little plastic tags that come in different colors that, mm-hmm. you know, come around bags of bread or bags of milk. In Canada, we have the milk in bags, which is apparently unique to our country. But over the years, it was, why don't we throw these things away? Like, I just had them piling up. And so that was interesting to me. Like, what is it about these particular things that we just keep not wanting to let go of? And I started collecting the tags and didn't really have a purpose for them. And then I think I posted on social media about them, like, do other people do this? And everyone responded, oh yeah. And then ended up asking people to send their tags to me. And again, not quite sure what I was going to do with them, but they're sort of pretty. And I had some, maybe I could make some kind of sculpture out of them, or maybe I could make a collage or, you know, and I was thinking about sewing them onto paper. And anyway, it kind of fell by the wayside. And then during COVID, I got them out again and started arranging them. I'd done a lot of quilting in the past. And so there's a real repetition with quilting. Mm-hmm.
And it's collaborative too. I mean, it's like your project is people were giving you the tags from their own collections. Quilting is very often a very collaborative process too.
Yeah. Now you create something, but then, you know, in a different time, people would have got together to finish the quilt. So this became sort of, how can people help me collaborate? And it's interesting because there's a local organization here called Roots to Harvest that feeds people and fed a lot of people during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And they were giving me tags. And then there were daycares as well that, you know, feed kids a lot. Like, and so it was became kind of a community project. And then, as I was saying about the quilting, the repetition, the challenge is, how do you make something unique within the constraint of a repetition? Like, there's very traditional patterns.
Yeah.
And then so I started just sort of arranging these tags in, you know, sometimes just in rows along paper and sometimes very randomly. And then they started eventually to kind of go out of the grid a bit. So that was interesting. But the short version, I think, to get back to your original question was, like, why are we keeping these things? What is the value in them? And then questions of, like, what's, you know, the tiny details of life for me, you know, are often where we find meaning. And I think that's where I ended up going, you know, what meaning is it? Are there in these tags? And the tags themselves have codes on them. What do those codes mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
This is not the first time that I've seen bread bag tag art, but the way you've put it together, and particularly the way you've put it together with the poem, felt incredibly fresh. I guess because you yourself have framed this work within COVID to a certain extent, within the mundanity, the melancholy, the loneliness, but also the sort of satisfaction of doing repetitive tasks. Mm-hmm. It really speaks in a whole new way, I think. And I think that poem that is included in your piece is also, for me anyway, certainly frames the way I'm interpreting the art. Mm-hmm. But in that poem, you talk about the overturned cutlery drawer in many senses, in many ways. Tell us a little bit about that, because I love the way that the overturned cutlery drawer becomes this motif of multiple emotions. Mm-hmm. It's not just, ugh, I have to fix it. It's so many, it represents so much for you. So could you just tell us a little bit about that?
Well, like, you know, those spaces in your home, I guess, that become kind of like this archaeological dig, you know, you especially if you have like kids and or you've just been there for a while and, you know, you open this drawer and it's just filled with all this detritus of life, right? And then, you know, if it's in your kitchen, it's probably got like a wine spill and a you know, hardened milk and like honey and, you know, and so COVID, I think people sort of went a couple of ways. Some people accumulated and some people kind of cleared out. And I think I was more of the clearer outer sort. And we all had time to be at home to do this stuff. So I remember sort of opening this drawer and there's like 1,000 things in it. And, you know, I list some of them in the poem, like, you know, these bread tags and twist ties and bits of Lego and, you know, crumbs and just to clear it out, like to take every single thing out of a drawer is kind of a bit of a double dog dare, because am I going to put this stuff in, or are we going to end up with this stuff on the counter for the next 4 weeks while I ignore it? But then to fully clean out any kind of holding space like that, to fully go in and, like, you know, get a wet cloth and clean out the corners and then carefully put everything back in order. The satisfaction of that was so immense.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'd open the drawer and just like look at this beautiful, orderly space. And then I'd be like, oh my God, I'm the kind of person whose life has become so small that this is the like such a source of joy. So there's this kind of like, this is what COVID was like. Like, our worlds are so small that we're finding, you know, or I was at least, you know, looking for the joy in the domestic. And I mean, that's not something that was reserved for me for COVID. Like, so I think it's that tension, to get back to maybe the larger themes, like, where is meaning in life? Is it in the tiniest corner of your home, in the tiniest bit of plastic, or is it in these huge, like, public facing kinds of projects? And I think the answer is obviously both.
Yeah.
And then COVID, I think, just brought it literally home, because we all had to stay home.
Right. This is why I find this piece so evocative of many, many large questions in food studies and in non-food studies, but just food systems, that we are both in the minutiae and the detail and the repetition, as well as the transformation and the change and the large scale. I mean, what makes our field so curious and complicated, because it's operating at multiple scales at all times.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's impossible to show in conventional food studies research, but you have shown this very clearly in what some might consider, I'm putting this in giant air quotes, just some food art, right? It isn't just some food art. It's actually a representation of all of the things that you've just mentioned and all of the big questions and the small questions that make up our food systems.
Yeah. Like, if you think about, like, okay, food, like, you know, a quarter teaspoon of some spice to, you know, like the entire system and, you know, like this one tag around your loaf of bread, but then the 18 tags in your drawer and then all your friends start sending you tags in the air, you know, and like, just, I think if you look at the collages, if you sort of zoom in on one tag and then you get this larger and larger picture where it just repeats and repeats and repeats, it's like, oh, like everybody's doing this. Everybody's trying to feed their kids who has kids with more or less success, depending on a whole bunch of factors. And then, yeah, everybody's in their houses just trying to get through.
And the personal is universal in many ways. And the scales of food, all those tags, that's a lot of plastic waste if you don't turn it into art, if you don't do something with it. And that's maybe one of the reasons that we do hold on to these things and save them, because we can't stand just throwing them out over and over.
Yeah. Apparently they're phasing out plastic tags for paper ones.
Yes, I've heard of that. Yes. Which is probably a good thing, but maybe not for the artists among us.
We'll become, you know, when I was a kid, did you ever see bubblegum, not bubblegum, but like chewing gum wrapper chains?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So maybe you will not be surprised to hear that I made those again, kind of saving the wrappers. I have one with my best friend and I made one over many years and I still have it, but you can't get those wrappers anymore.
Right.
Nobody makes stick gum like that anymore. So all of a sudden it's incredibly valuable for the weirdos who want to make those kinds of chains. But, you know, I have bags and bags of these things still in my studio desk drawers and I wonder what I'll do with them. Yeah.
Well, so apparently you're not the only one and I'm not the only one who's fascinated by these objects. Because, as you mentioned in the piece, you discovered a website, horg.com, H-O-R-G.com. I'll put it in the show notes. It stands for the Holotypic Oklupanid Research Group, where Oklupanida are closures of bread. And so it's this very specific research group dedicated to small plastic tags. How did you find this website?
Oh, people send me stuff about bread tags all the time. So someone just sent me that. Yeah, it's, I mean, that's obviously a satire, but they're, you know, just looking at them as the, like, this is a very specific type of fern or something, but, you know, just classifying the different tags. Yeah, people always would want to send me their interpretations of what the codes on the tags mean. And like, I've never found any of them to hold. I mean, obviously the dates, there's cities, there's times, but the colors were never consistent. My friends in the United States have a whole different system of tags, and they, you know, I could get very specific US ones, which are really valuable. But yeah, people are fascinated by this stuff. And I love when people are paying attention to those tiny details.
Yeah.
The
site itself is very, it's very whimsical. It's very funny. Yes. But it's also extremely rigorous.
Yes.
It is a research group. It is a very formalized taxonomies that they've constructed.
And you know, it's someone's job to make these, right? Probably many people's jobs.
Yes. Yeah. Like, it exposes a whole, I mean, if you start probing it, it exposes the whole network of labor, of materials, of the Anthropocene, of everything.
Yeah.
Fabulous. So are you continuing to make art with the bread tags? Or is that a temporal part of your life?
It's slowed down a lot. I can't make myself get rid of the tags. I'm kind of thinking now about sculpture. I'd like to do something where maybe like there's a 3D sculpture where it's lit from within. So, and I'm starting to think about, like, right now they're sort of two-dimensional flat on paper, and I'm kind of wondering about how to stack them, you know, and have maybe light behind them, or just, you know, make them a lot more dense. For the moment, I'm not actively making art, but I have ideas.
Interesting. So you are not a food scholar in your professional life. You're a psychotherapist, as I understand it, yeah?
Yeah, and that's pretty new. I came to psychotherapy after about 25 years as a freelance writer and editor.
Okay. So how did you find our journal for your piece? I'm sort of fascinated how the journal is pretty well known within the Canadian Association for Food Studies, but beyond that group, it's a little bit less well known. So I was wondering how you found us and why you decided to publish your great piece with us.
It was really interesting because as a writer, you know, you think about places to publish your work and you don't really think about food stuff, you know, like it hadn't occurred to me. So it was this moment of, oh, that's right. Like if you want your work to reach people, then I hadn't really thought of it as a piece about food.
Okay.
You know, I thought a lot about repetition and quilting and domesticity and kids and COVID, but I hadn't really clued in that even though it was literally called Milk and Bread, that this was food art. And so having that pointed out to me and having this venue suggested to me, I was like, it just was a, oh, of course that makes sense. So that's how that connection came about.
Well, I'm glad because it really, I mean, as we discussed, it reveals so much about so many parts of our world, both food and not. And I think that's what's so wonderful about food studies generally is it does, it touches, it connects, it relates all these aspects of the world together. And that's exactly what we should do when it comes to food, because food is everything, right? Well, thank you very much for this conversation. I will hope that you will think of us for a future publication if you do indeed make more art that is somehow related to food, because I think it's a great way for people to understand the stories that you're telling and think differently and maybe similarly about our subject.
Yeah, I mean, I think like so much of the work I do as a writer, you know, it's the story attached to the data that makes the data relevant, you know? And so, yeah, I would love to keep participating because for writers to think about their work as more than just words, more than just literary, you know, like you don't just publish necessarily in a literary journal, but where might this work have an impact in places you haven't thought?
Yeah, for sure. Well, we appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was lovely to be here.
Hayley Workington has a BA in Anthropology and English Literature from the University of British Columbia, and she recently completed a Master in Communication with a specialization in climate change at Carleton University's School of Journalism and Communication. She has long explored how storytelling creates and shapes our worldviews, including what stories both include and exclude from such narratives.
Hi, I'm Kaylee Workington, a recent graduate from the School of Journalism and Communication at Carleton University, where I completed my master's in communication with a specialization in climate change. My thesis, After the Forest Burns, Storying Wildfire in Western Canada Through Visual Material Narratives, explores how we tell stories of ecological loss through craft by considering the forest after it burns as a site of creation as much as it is a space of loss. From pigment made with ochres transformed by heat, to wildfire used as a kiln to fire clay, or to tree ring prints made from felled and fallen trees. At the heart of this work is the idea that art and storytelling, especially slow, material forms of making, can hold what data or climate modeling often can't. Grief, memory, imagination, and the quiet, continued resilience of communities at the forefront of the climate crisis. A question that feels endlessly urgent and that I often return to is how we tell stories of ecological loss in a way that feels livable and sustaining, not immobilizing or apocalyptic, but rooted and local. I found my way to these stories through slowness, through acts of making that encourage me to pay attention. And I found that materiality, the tactility of the climate crisis as it manifests in color, in heat, in smell, offers an entirely different entry point to climate storytelling. Climate change isn't just a number or a chart or a threshold. It's the toothbrush that you pack in an evacuation bag. It's the box of art, the only box that you carry in your arms, out to your truck. And I saw the ways in which these materials, like wildfire pigments or charred wood, became storytelling tools. They were both what was lost and what was left. With Susan Goldberg's Milk and Bread collage series, I feel a really deep relationship between our work. Both contend with the animacy of the inanimate, with objects that hold stories and refuse to stay silent. In Goldberg's case, it's the bits of plastic we hardly see. Bread in milk tags, plastic utensils, and an overfilled cutlery drawer. Made during the isolating stillness of the COVID-19 pandemic, these collages document the rhythm of domestic life. Meals, childcare, grief, uncertainty, and sustenance. She writes, "I glued, arranged, color-coded, and marked the time, the relentless domesticity, the uncertain closeness, the creativity of constraint, the plasticity of time, marking the days and details of the moment in a medium designed to be disposable that would ultimately survive us all." What I find really striking is that the materials that have exacerbated wildfire and other extreme climate events and fossil fuel derivatives like plastic are what linger. But what we're losing, the sound of melting glaciers, words for snow, species we haven't yet named, disappear quickly, so quickly that they barely have time to register in our collective consciousness. Goldberg's work reminds me that catastrophe often looks like ordinary life, and that the carrier bag, to borrow from speculative fiction author Ursula K. Le Guin, may be the most urgent storytelling structure that we have. A place to hold what doesn't fit neatly into narrative arcs, a place for the bread tag, and the seeds that have yet to germinate. In my thesis, I often thought about what we carry, about the heaviness of climate loss and how we bear it. The artists I interviewed, many of whom are not formally trained, taught me that storytelling can be as simple as sharing a pigment made from ochres burned by fire. These acts are not spectacle, they're sustenance. And like Goldberg's collages, they emerge from constraint, from what we can salvage, from what we're given. There's also something profoundly feminist in her work, in elevating domestic labor and treating caregiving and meal making as worthy of artistic attention, in resisting the traditional hierarchies of what counts as serious narrative. Returning to Le Guin, she celebrates the vessel over the weapon, gathering instead of conquest. Goldberg's collages are carrier bags, and they hold what we can't always say out loud. Goldberg's work is not only an archive, but I think it could also be a method. What can we learn from the textures of our own lives, from the everyday detritus that accumulates in our pockets or our drawers or our memory? How do we document what we're living through without needing to make it grand or universal? Goldberg offers a blueprint for that, work made in community, out of care, in conversation with crisis, but not swallowed by it.
I wonder, is this episode now at an end? If you tap your phone or keyboard and replay the last 25 minutes or so, will you hear those words in the same way? Or has listening once changed your perception forever? Not to say that this podcast is transcendent or transformational, but doesn't experience of anything alter everything going forward? And what of that twist tie you just threw in the trash can? Was it the flapping butterfly wings of a new age of climate confusion, or just another grain of sand in the maelstrom? A few things to speculate about the next time you're tensely watching reports of summertime forest fires or urgently reorganizing a kitchen drawer. Thank you to today's guests, Alexia Moyer, Susan Goldberg, and Kaylee Workington. Our executive producers for this and every episode are Rachel Engler-Stringer, Laurence Godin, Charles Levko, Phil Loring, and Kristen Lowett. I'm David Santo. Coming up in the season, we'll revisit the subject of food art, a sound installation this time, rather than material collages and poetry. In the meantime, consider submitting your food creations to Canadian Food Studies, whether they're audiovisual, design-based, digital, or conceptual. Everyone is welcome to join in the conversation and collaborate in making us more thoughtful about food and the planet. On the subject of art, you know those classic still-life paintings from 17th century Dutch artists showing an array of food and other objects? Well, according to historians, lemons were very commonly depicted in such paintings because they symbolized both colonial wealth and the complexity of human emotions. During this golden age of Dutch painting, more than 250,000 still-lifes were created, and more than half of them portrayed lemons in various states of freshness and decay. How's that for a juicy little factoid?